Good morning, church. Excited as 2014. New year. Isn't that amazing how fast time flies and realize that we're getting into this century a good bit? And today I want to take a risk at boring you more than normal. But I would like to take a risk at boring you and talking about something that occurred in the first half of the 20th century, something that happened over the last 100 years. And actually, it was a war that was fought that most people are not really aware of. Although, we talk about it in terms all the time. And what it was a war over economic theory. I know you're excited, huh? We're going to talk about economic theory for a minute. But really what it was a war about how economies grow and what makes it work and who has the power to affect it. And coming into the 20th century, the prevalent theory was that free markets, that markets ultimately figured out what was best for people. And if people left to themselves, ultimately worked things out, that wages were earned based on what the market required and things cost what they cost based on what the market would bear. And then World War I and World War II happened, and other theories of economies and how economics worked began to rise to the surface. And the reason is because people don't understand one of the big pushers was that World War I and World War II cost a tremendous amount of money. And the economic need was really felt, and things were beginning to fall apart. And so there was offered from a guy named John Keynes, a British economist, the idea that ultimately we need to get away from the idea of free market and that governments in and of themselves have the power to control money and to make unemployment disappear and all these things by simply profound spending. And this began to rise to the surface. The reason it got traction was because things were very, very bad. And so what happened is, you know, in the early, right after World War II, European economy started to get rid of gold as the standard for currency. And then, of course, we know here that in the 70s, Americans got rid of the gold standard. And since then, things have changed a great deal. And a lot of people don't understand how much things change. Your grandparents talk about it all the time. You young guys, man, when I was a kid, a gallon of gas was a nickel, you know, that sort of thing. And we talk about how much a Hershey bar was or you know, how much it cost to go to the movie theater, all these things. But actually, all of those price changes are in direct relationship to this economic war that was fought, this theory over economic war. And actually, what I like to say is that, you know, from 1950 to 1978, the Keynesian model was followed almost to a T. And a lot of people say, well, we're starting to get away from that, sort of. But actually, I would liken it unto giving somebody a dose of very, very high radiation. Is that the person may walk around for a while completely normally, but they're a dead man already. And I sort of think that that's sort of the way it is. Not to bum you out. You know, God has a way of bringing people through, and God has his own thing. We have to trust in the Lord. The sovereignty of God is more important now than it ever has been in my lifetime. But you have to understand that that economic war was fought. And what happened was there was a guy named Milton Friedman, who a lot of people advocate him as a really good guy. I would not say he was a deeply principled man. I wouldn't say he was a morally upright man. But he believed in this old model, the free market idea. And his criticisms of Keynesian economics were simply, they were wide. But one of the ones that I really enjoy reading from him is that people who hold to this Keynesian model, that governments can do all this stuff, is that these people really ascribe what they wish were true of human nature rather than what is true of human nature. That this Keynesian model of economic theory really depends on human beings being basically good. It depends on government sort of naturally being good for people. And there's sort of that idea. And Milton Friedman said, you know, the issue here is a naivety, that human beings, the problem with human beings is that when you give them too much room to fiddle with stuff, they fiddle with stuff. And actually, what we're looking at today in the book of Galatians is Paul criticizing that exact human characteristic. I know that seems like a long-winded way of getting there, but I want you to understand, it pops up in every part of your life. And I'll even put it on a simple basis. When you have a scab on your knee, what do you do to it? You pick at it. In fact, your mom always said, don't pick that, it'll never heal, right? And that didn't stop you one whit, did it? You just keep picking at it. That's what people do. We can't leave anything alone. We just sort of fiddle with it, constantly fiddling. And as a result, we break it. And that was one of those things, another economist, a guy I really enjoy reading because he's funny, is a guy named George Stigler. And George Stigler said, you know what the problem with universities is? What we need to do is hold universities financially liable for all of the lies that they teach. He said, if we did that, then all this foolishness would disappear. He's a really funny guy, but he also has passed away. But as Paul writes here to the Galatians, he has given them a gospel. And I want you to understand that the gospel as we have it presented in the New Testament, the gospel that Paul delivered, was a gospel in which God provided the judgment and the means to escape judgment. God provided justice but also mercy to answer his justice. In other words, God has done all of the work. And that seems like it should be tremendously beneficial to people. It seems like it should be tremendously restful for people. But that's not human nature. Human nature takes what God has given and we start to pick at it. We start to fiddle with it. We start to control it and try and make it our own. And as a result, we break it. And it goes for scabs and it goes for economies. Human beings are constantly fiddling. And so we mess things up. So here, we pick up in verse 6. And with all of that in mind, I want you to read verse 6 with me of chapter 1 of the book of Galatians. I'm amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel. You see what I mean? You see what I mean? Paul's right there. He says, you guys, I'm absolutely amazed. I just turned around. I just left you. And so quickly, you are already deserting. And I want you to notice what they're deserting. That you are so quickly deserting him, Jesus, who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel. You're abandoning Christ. You're abandoning the Father. You who are called by grace and this thing which is so supremely accomplished by grace. And we need to understand grace from a couple of different perspectives. And I want you to understand this. And this has to be very clear in the mind of every Christian for them to persist and understand the gospel in a durable way. Grace is unmerited favor. That is, I favor you, I give you my beneficence, I like you, but there's nothing about you that would make me do so. Okay? And that's really the case of it. For every person in this room who has a child, this makes perfect sense. You don't love your children because they perform. You love your children because they're yours. And in fact, many of you can report that you love your children and they're doing everything they can to beat your love into the ground. And you can't stand the way that they are, right? And I see some parents looking sideways at their children. You're bad kids. Okay, I want you to understand, if your parent looks at you in this moment, you're a bad kid. But everybody else, you kind of understand. Actually, I understand this. There was a friend of mine years ago, and his name was Darren, right? Darren and Doran. Yeah, just writes itself. It's so stupid. But Darren and I were both violinists in the orchestra together, and we shared sections, and we were the two top seats for our section. And then we also spent all of our spare time riding around in his 74 Vega station wagon, doing what boys do, right? Going to orchestra, you know, like boys do. Just, honestly, it's so sad. It's so sad. But I'm going to tell you a secret. I couldn't stand Darren. I just didn't like him. There are a lot of things I just didn't like him. And there's the truth of it. I remember one day we got in this thing, and to be honest with you, I was always struggling with just a little edginess to him. And we got in this thing, and I stabbed him in the chest. It wasn't bad, but I did. I stabbed him in the chest with a, it hit a rib, and it was fine. But it was a different time. It was a different time. Don't get upset. But, you know, you just, but Darren never gave up. He operated in a standpoint of grace towards me all the time. He constantly loved me. He was my friend, even though I just wasn't particularly good to him. I was horrible to him. And I'll be honest with you, he never held me stabbing him in the chest against him. I mean, that's a good friend. I understand grace. I've been a recipient of it. And it really, it wasn't bad. It was just a couple of inches. So, and boy, it bled. And I remember telling him, look, you tell anybody, we're both going to get in trouble. And he bought it. Anyway. But grace is unmerited favor. It is the idea that this person is not worthy of the recipient of reciprocity or receiving this thing, but I'm going to give him unmerited favor. The other way you need to think about it is what we oftentimes use as the acronym for this word, God's righteousness at Christ's expense. That is, that God's grace was purchased for us. It's a gift. So if we think about it in that sense, so Paul here is writing and he says, I can't believe, first time I turn my back, you guys are deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ and instead are picking up a different gospel. Gospel means good news, a Godspiel gospel, good news. You're exchanging good news, and he says this, for a different gospel. Verse 7, which is really not another gospel at all. Only there are some who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. You see what he's saying? You guys are taking the gospel as it's been presented, a gospel based in grace, a gospel based in the work of God's, of God at Christ's expense, a gospel of unmerited favor, and you are being disturbed because some people are distorting it. They're tweaking it. They're picking at it. And Paul says, so much so that it's no longer the gospel at all. And folks, this is where we start to hit what we picked up last week. Remember, once you add something other than Christ working, it's no longer Christ working anymore. It's us doing something. And you substitute works for a clear grace-based gospel. And Paul says this is already happening. Verse 8. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to what we've preached to you, he's to be accursed. As we have said before, so I say again now, if any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to what you received, he's to be accursed. And we're going to look at two things here. Paul says, you've got to hang on to the gospel. And it's going to be hard because there are constantly people around you who are going to want to tweak it, who are going to want to pick at it, who are constantly want to distort it. And it's our nature to fall for that. Christian, you've got to get this cemented in your mind, and you got to be aware of it. And it's something which I, even after all these years of being solidly committed to the gospel, of understanding, I think, as well as anybody should or can at this point in my career, I recognize that there's going to be a part of me that is prone to fall back on man-based, works-based, anti-grace gospel. I have to understand that. It is man's nature to be works-based. It's what we do. In the same way that many of you, if you have bad alignment on your car, that you're riding down the road, and if you take your hands off the wheel, your car goes off the road. Everybody's probably been in that situation. I know I have, because I don't take my car to the shop as I should to get these kinds of things fixed. And when I look at it and I go, hey, they're getting bald on one side, I go, maybe I should go get Rich to fix that. And I walk in and Rich goes, you need new tires, right? Because I'm prone to just not deal with this thing. I want you to understand, we're prone to drift. We're prone to not be aligned on truth. We're prone to pick at it. In the same way that Milton Friedman said, you know, the thing is, we project on economies what we hope to be true about human nature rather than the reality of human nature. And Christian, that's what people do. We don't like to think of ourselves as sinners. We don't like to think of ourselves as prone to wander. We don't like to think of ourselves as naturally deficient. It's human nature to want to say, I can, and I will, and I can do this, instead of saying, God have pity on me, a sinner. It's just not our nature. And as a result of that, we're prone to drift away from a grace-based gospel, from God's righteousness at Christ's expense. That's what we're prone to do. And Paul makes no bones about it as he approaches this thing and he says, look, I want you to be clear. The gospel, this grace-based gospel, is a non-negotiable. And here's what you do when you hear a gospel which is opposite this gospel. Let that gospel and that person that you're hearing it from be accursed. In fact, he says it in very strong words in verse 8. Even if it's me, or an angel from heaven, if we are preaching to you a different gospel than that which you've heard, let me, let them, let that angel be accursed. And people here sort of project on this that Paul is speaking in hyperbole. But really, there are two religions that today claim angelic authority for their message. One is Mormonism. Mormonism, as you know, there was an angel supposedly named Moroni who came to Joseph Smith and gave him a revelation of a new gospel. And actually, what they called it, and if you get into this deeply with Mormons today, they will say that Mormonism is a correction of New Testament Christianity. That New Testament Christianity, the New Testament Bible, has become corrupted, and God sent a revelation to Joseph Smith through an angel to correct the errors of the gospel. And Mormonism is very, very clear that it teaches Christ's work on the cross plus our work. And you realize what's happened is a distortion of the gospel that Paul gave. And actually, an angel did it, an angel. The other one is Islam. Islam, and it seems like most Christians aren't even aware of this, but Islam claims part of its revelation was through an angel, that an angel appeared to Muhammad and gave to him a correction of the New Testament gospel. That it's 600 A.D. The idea was that the Bible was the Word of God, but it has become corrupted and so has missed the mark, and that Islam is a correction of what the original gospel was. And so the angel there gives a reconciliation or a fixing of what Christians and Jews have ultimately messed up. You got to understand, when Paul says, if me or an angel from heaven give you another gospel, Paul there is not speaking out of the realm of imagination. A supernatural being could show up and say, I am from God. Let me correct something that you've heard. And Paul says, I don't care if that happens. If that happens, reject it. Because the gospel as it had been revealed through Christ and as revealed through his apostles is the only one that can save. And it is a gospel of grace, God's righteousness at Christ's expense, unmerited favor. Your work never plays in to your salvation, to God's justifying work in your life. Christian, you've got to hang on to that. And then again, he says this word both times, let him be accursed. And then he says in verse 9, as we've said before, so I say again now, if any man's preaching to you a gospel contrary to what you received, let him be accursed. This is a Greek word called anathema. Now, as you know, I don't often give you words from the original language. The reason I don't give you words from the original language is because most of the time it's not helpful. And preachers tend to drag them out because it preaches well and it highlights the fact that we went to school. Okay? We like everybody to know we went to school and studied these languages and therefore you can listen to us. But most of the time, the Greek word is nothing different than the English word. In fact, I often will point out that when you have a Greek word, it is most often what I call a general word. That it's translated 15 or 20 different ways. And that really the 15 or 20 different ways that it's translated is determined by context. And you don't have to know the original language to understand context. All you have to do is to be able to read and to think. Okay? Now, raise your hand if you can read. Most people here, okay, raise your hand if you can think. Okay, you are now a theologian. You don't actually have to know Greek most of the time. This is one of the rare occasions where it helps. Because the word here, accursed, is not what I call a general word. Many people know my favorite illustration for a general word is the word sanctification. Sanctification is not a complex word. Sanctification is a general rule word. It just means set apart, right? So I can set apart a pair of shoes for you. I can set apart your glasses. I could say these belong to Doran because these are his glasses. They're therefore sanctified. That's all it means. It's not some highfalutin word. But anathema, that actually is a very technical word. So general words, technical words. The word anathema is a technical word, and you're going to love it. This is what it means. Intentionally set apart to destruction. Intentionally set apart to destruction. That's what it means. It's a technical word. And you say, well, I don't understand what that means. Well, envision it this way. When I was a kid, I would build with Lincoln Logs. You remember Lincoln Logs, right? They were great. They were made of wood. Made it feel like it was real, right? And I would build little buildings with Lincoln Logs, and I would fill those Lincoln Logs with toy soldiers, the little cheap soldiers you get in the grocery store, the ones that were all green in this world that God had created with all green people who had matched their clothes to their faces. All green. And I would put them in the building in different ways as if they were shooting out. And my brothers and I would get our little saucer guns and our little yellow BB guns, you know, the little yellow ones, and we would shoot those soldiers, and we would also shoot sections of the building trying to topple it. And then as a section of the building would topple, we would go through the rubble and determine how these guys had died. Say, oh, yeah, this guy, his head was crushed by a log. And this is what boys do. Right? We stab our friends and we kill a little Lincoln Log building. This is what we do. But certainly I'm not alone in this, right? Don't boys do this, right? Yeah, okay. Hey, Karen's giving me the nod. Yeah, this is what they do. So anyway, that's what we would do. But I want you to understand, the building was built for no other purpose than for me to destroy it. That's what it's... That's anathema. The only thing it was good for, its only purpose, its only use, was so that I could destroy it. The only reason I put in the time to build it was so that I could destroy it. In essence, that's what Paul is saying here. The only reason God would allow such a gospel to pop up is so that he could destroy it. This is very strong language. Paul says it twice. Whether an angel from heaven or even me, if I come to you and give you a different gospel other than the one that you've been given, let me be anathema. Let me be set apart unto destruction. Let it be that I would come for no other purpose than that God would destroy me. That's strong language. And it says a couple of things. One is that fake gospel can do nothing. That fake gospel, that twisted gospel, that gospel that may look innocuous and talk about Jesus and claim to be a correction of what's been perverted. But now in this modern age, we have to update. We have to change with the times. We have to just tweak or fiddle or pick at the gospel just a little, not much. But once you do that, it is no longer a gospel which can save. It is worthless. It is good for nothing. Isn't that amazing? Paul is saying, any gospel rooted in this fiddling of man, any gospel rooted even in the fiddling of supernatural forces, ultimately is useless. And the second thing is, it will be destroyed. Why all the strong language? Well, Christian, I want you to understand. In the same way that Milton Friedman sort of tacked on to the human nature to fiddle and to project on things what we wish were true, that's also what we do when it comes to God's things. There is something in us, like bad alignment on a car, that we are just prone to take truth from God's perspective, which is the only perspective that matters, to take God's gospel as it's been delivered, and to want to make it about something I can do, about some work I can add to it, about some measure by which I could earn a free gift, by which I could really be deserving and perhaps not be perfect, but perhaps be better enough than the next guy, that I'm not in as big a need as the next guy of salvation, and there's something in me that's better or special. That's just what we're prone to do. Paul understands it, and I'm telling you, these gospels, as they have presented through the years, have constantly gained audience after audience after audience. And Paul here, remember, as we were talking last week, Paul here is dealing with two heresies. One is Gnosticism. The other is the Judaizers, Judaism. Judaism, which has walked away from its Old Testament root, and it has become really about me working my way to God. And Paul says, look, I am amazed at how quickly you guys who understood the gospel, who responded to the gospel, who began to walk in the gospel, are already starting to hedge and fall back on man's willing and man's work. Already. That's who we are. Many Christians are not convinced of that. I tell you, if you're not convinced of that, you are a candidate for falling into this error. It's got to be the willing and the working of God. It's got to be Christ alone. It's got to be the cross plus nothing. And this is one of the few areas where when Paul is speaking, notice the harshness of the language. He says it two verses successively. Look, anybody teaching you anything else other than grace-based, Christ-alone gospel, let them be set apart to destruction. Because their gospel cannot save, and their gospel is only good for destruction. That's all it's good for. It is set apart unto it. Christian, hang on to truth. Resolve in the new year to become so acquainted with the doctrines of grace that you cannot deviate from them. Resolve in the new year to be so much about God's business that you recognize the counterfeits that are going to come and have come. This world is filled with 1,000 counterfeit gospels. And many of them we spot because they're so alien to us. When we come across Hinduism, or we come across Buddhism, or we come across any number of New Age philosophies, those things strike us as error. But one of the ways into the Christian's mind is to use the language of Christianity without the content of it. To talk about Jesus. To talk about grace, but not really grace. You realize that many people, there's a huge conception out there among people that when you talk to them about grace, they don't view it as a relationship that I'm in. Remember, I told you before, unmerited favor, that God actually favors me because I'm His. It has nothing to do with me. Some people don't view grace as a relationship. They view it as like gasoline. That it's a commodity. That when I want grace or need grace, what I do is I have to go to a well and get it. And that well could be obtained. A priest can give me grace. Or I can say enough prayers and so obtain grace. That in essence I'm dipping grace out for myself. And that's not true. You realize how quickly that can happen? The conception of grace in that mode is absolutely antagonistic to its definition. But there are counterfeit gospels out there preaching this stuff all the time. And if you use Jesus' name, well, that seems like it's a foot in the door. Seems like I should listen because I'm a Christian and this person is talking about Jesus. Beware. Because I want you to know that Paul here is fighting for a grace-based God all does all the work gospel, Christ righteousness, God's righteousness at Christ's expense. He's fighting for it, not against people who are saying Jesus is junk, but actually he's fighting for that gospel against people who would say Jesus plus. Judaizers who would look like Christians, who would sound like Paul and the apostles, the Gnostics who talk in terms of really knowing the Lord and a heart for Jesus. But it's just works-based, wrapped up in a grace cocoon. In this year, resolve to become such a theologian, even those of you who are young, to become such a person who walks with Jesus, to become such a student of His Word, that you make much of God's business and recognize falsehood when you see it. Folks, this is the battle of our age. This is the challenge for the church. And it's your challenge as an individual believer. Many of you here say, well, I know all this, Pastor. I've heard this before. I know the gospel. Have a care. Because this age in which we live will so cleverly and consciously package Jesus differently that they will trick you if they can. It's just the way it is. And we've been fighting this battle for 2,000 years. Paul the Apostle, a guy who preached and taught better than I ever shall, cemented the gospel with the Galatians and they still fell into error, don't think that you're above it. Make much of the Lord this year. Resolve in your hearts to be God's people and to hang on to grace above all else. Let's go to prayer.